Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It really is about more than just going and buying your food and taking it home. It's about economically your community, but also socially. And that is an extremely important thing. It's not just always about nutrients.
Shopping as a way of getting in touch with your community. I chat with chef and author Clara Moore. We take a field trip to Uplands Peak Sanctuary to visit four very friendly pigs who were rescued and now get to live out the rest of their lives. Harvest Public Media goes to Colorado to find out how state regulators are making sure marijuana-infused foods are safe to eat. And a soup recipe with Chef Daniel Orr that's great warm and also chilled. Lots coming up today. A few stories this week from our news sources. Lou Ann Johnson has details.
On Tuesday, the Senate voted 68-32 in favor of the five-year bill, opening the way for President Barack Obama to sign the $1 trillion measure into law. In a statement, U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the legislation would achieve meaningful reform and billions of dollars in savings for the taxpayer. The bill includes provisions for a broad range of agriculture programs, including dairy farming, land conservation, and scaled-back food assistance for low-income Americans. The Congressional Budget Office said the bill would reduce spending by $16.6 billion over the next decade. But critics of the bill said reforms fell short. Cuts in unpopular direct subsidies to farmers were offset with crop insurance programs, which watchdogs said could actually increase the overall cost to taxpayers. Dan Smith with the U.S. Public Interest Research Groups called the move, quote, political sleight of hand that would continue to give handouts to large agribusinesses that don't need our tax dollars, unquote. A study commissioned by the Environmental Working Group found that the new program could cost taxpayers $20 billion more than direct payments over the next 10 years if prices fell, and increases crop insurance by nearly $6 billion by allowing farm businesses to guarantee revenue. Harvest Public Media will have more about how food and farm activists worked together to get the Farm Bill signed into law. Honeybees in farm country are under stress from several factors, including disease and a lack of nutritious food sources. Now, preliminary research from Iowa suggests that corn planting season is a particularly tough time for bees. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Pesticide treatment that coats most commercial corn seed can rub off during the course of mechanical planting. The dust that forms is then contaminated, and Iowa State University's Mary Harris says it can get vented into the air.
This exhausted air is what is providing the contamination that is then blown around and ends up on the flowers.
Harris's initial study found that foraging bees take pollen from contaminated flowers back to their brood. And it suggests that while colonies may not die, they're not as strong as they could be. Harris says this year she will expand the study, which was funded and published by the nonprofit Pollinator Partnership. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And Russia is considering a ban on GMOs that would restrict GMO imports and prohibit all domestic production. Though Russia does not currently restrict GMO products, the proposed bill would amend the On Safety and Quality of Alimentary Products law to include limits on the GMO properties of food. Supporters of the law say that banning domestic production will protect Russia from foreign companies launching GMO operations within its borders. Detractors argue that the bill puts Russian farmers and businesses at a disadvantage by denying them access to GMO technology. At least 26 countries have total or partial bans on GMOs, including many European countries, Australia, China, India, and Mexico. Read more about these stories at eartheats.org and connect with us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for Earth Eats.
Lou Ann Johnson with our food news. Thanks.
See you in a week.
President Obama signed the long-overdue Agriculture Act of 2014, the new Farm Bill, into law. Many people are sighing with relief. That includes farmers, of course, as well as advocates for food stamps. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explains, these two groups have been wedded together politically to generate urban and rural support for the Farm Bill, but it's been a rocky road.
To be sure, this has never been an easy marriage.
It's been an alliance and part of convenience.
That's Neil Hamilton, director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University in Des Moines.
This difficult process we went through over the last couple of years helped illuminate a lot of the fault lines and the places of tension between those different components of the political spectrum.
On the left, liberal nutrition advocates. On the right, fiscal conservatives looking to cut spending on food assistance and other programs. The Farm Bill actually expired in the fall of 2012, and it has taken years of negotiations to write the new one. Even though we call it the Farm Bill, it funds both farm subsidies and food stamps. In years past, linking the two in one bill meant most legislators had a vested interest in getting it done. But with Congress sharply divided on the funding for food stamps, called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the Farm Bill looked hopeless at times.
There was this rather startling thing that happened in June when the bill was defeated on the floor of the House, I think to the surprise certainly of a lot of the agricultural leaders.
Since the earliest farm supports in the 1930s, the link between those who grow food and those who need it has been part of federal agriculture policy. It became more urgent in the 1960s and 1970s as a way to keep urban lawmakers, eager to alleviate hunger in their districts, on board with farm subsidies. This time around, though, the tenuous relationship struggled to hang on.
Here's the vote. Marsha Fudge was one of the ones who voted for it.
And then, Dan Looker is the business editor at Successful Farming magazine. He's looking at the roll call in the House on the final bill. Democrats tended to vote no because of food stamp cuts. Marsha Fudge of Cleveland is a notable urban exception. So did 63 Republicans, for a different reason.
In the final vote on the Farm Bill in the House, I understand there wasn't a single vote from Kansas for the bill, and that's very, very unusual.
Looker says it's a reflection of Tea Party conservatives, the minority of House Republicans who played a big part in stalling progress on the Farm Bill. They wanted to cut the SNAP program so much they even succeeded in breaking farm policy apart from nutrition at one point last summer. But Drake's Neil Hamilton says that effort led to something of a legal separation, not quite a divorce. The Tea Party Republicans raised their concerns and certainly slowed the process. But in the final bill, they didn't get the deep cuts they wanted.
The cuts in the SNAP program were much smaller than they had desired to get, probably smaller than they could have gotten if they would have endorsed the bill in June.
Hamilton says one thing lacking in this year's rhetoric was a strong demonstration of the two sides' interdependence.
I would hope that one of the lessons and things that may happen is that the agricultural sector, right, the commodity organizations and others, might more fully embrace the value of nutrition programs.
Because a few facts remain. Farmers grow food, among other things. Hungry people need food. Helen Jensen, an economist at Iowa State University, says the Farm Bill aims to help both groups.
Food is certainly tied very closely to agriculture and historically was tied in ways of looking at how do we use the agricultural product to support both people who were very hungry and also support farmers.
She says that although the pairing of farm and food policies got stretched and challenged this go-round, she thinks it's here to stay. And Dan Looker agrees, pointing out that this time, ag was coming off strong years and the overall economy was emerging from recession. If those roles are reversed next time, things could look quite different.
It's very possible that 5 years from now, food stamps won't be a huge issue, and farmers may need support from the Farm Bill more than they do today.
For richer or poorer, it looks like the sides can celebrate another anniversary before getting busy figuring out exactly how the new law will impact their operations. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Another story from Harvest Public Media coming up in the second half of our show. Clara Moore made a name for herself in the St. Louis food scene when she worked as executive chef at the local Harvest Cafes. Last year, she picked up and moved to the Pacific Northwest, which resulted in what she called food culture shock. She had to learn about the growing season, which is much shorter than what she was used to in Missouri. And fresh seafood, that was new for her, too. Her technique for getting to know a new place is to go shopping at the local co-ops, mom-and-pop corner stores, and ethnic markets. She talks to people and engages with the food system firsthand.
Not just go to the store like a robot, take the food off the shelves, go through the line, and then go home and unpack it. It's really much more than that. Your butcher knows so much about meat. Ask them what is good today. Ask them what they recommend. Ask them if there's a cheaper cut that you could use. And then the same with the farmers. Or also ask your farmer if they have an excess of something that they might want to let go for a deal. Farmers are business people, and they definitely want to move their product. So whatever they can do to move their product, they're happy with.
Her first cookbook is called Shop Like a Chef, so I asked her for tips the rest of us should keep in mind when we hit the grocery store. First thing she recommends is to buy food more than just once a week.
That's something I would recommend to anyone, anywhere, all the time.
Just shop more often.
Yes, exactly. Especially if you are really interested in seasonal and local, really understanding the diversity of what you can get. The more often you shop, the more you see things changing, and the more you see new stuff, the more you can be inspired.
Relive your days working at Local Harvest in St. Louis. You're shopping for the ingredients for that day. Do you make a list, or you just sort of go to the store and see how the spirit moves you?
I would say half and half. So I like to have kind of a general idea. This is for home and for work, honestly. I like to have a general idea of what I may want to eat that week or in the next few days. And then kind of leave them open-ended, like, you know, I'd like to eat chicken. So I pick my protein, and then I go and see what I can mix with that. What's going to be at the store that's going to inspire me or that's going to look so beautiful I can't not pick it up?
So let's say you're going to make a gorgeous chicken, pasta, zucchini meal. What is an absolute must? Which ingredient must be local, which must be organic, and which can you sort of play with?
That is a lot of like a minefield. That's a minefield of a question.
Purposely.
Right. So I would say if it's going to be organic, I tend towards meat, my meats being organic. Because I feel like there's a lot more life and a lot more things packed into proteins and meat. Vegetables, I find, should more be local because they're just going to taste better. You know, you can freeze an organic chicken in Washington and send it to Missouri, and it's going to taste basically relatively the same. But you can't pick a zucchini in a field in Washington and then fly it to St. Louis and think it's going to taste as good.
Then I'm also wondering, now that you've moved out there, you're cooking more at home than you ever had at any point in your life. Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything from that? Is there anything you've picked up from just having to do it all the time?
Yes, I have. First of all, I use my freezer a lot. I'll make like a lot of rice, and then I freeze the rice. And frozen rice is surprisingly versatile, and you can use it for lots of stuff. Breaking down chicken and then freezing it, breaking down meat and then freezing it. So when you buy in bigger quantities and cook in bigger quantities, you're saving yourself money and time.
She's also now planning ahead with her cooking, preparing meals for the week on Sunday. All in all, she's thoughtful about where she shops, how often, and what she takes home with her. Moore says this gives her food depth.
It really is about more than just going and buying your food and taking it home. It really is about your community. It's about economically your community, but also socially. And that is an extremely important thing. It's not just always about nutrients.
Clara Moore is the author of Shop Like a Chef, A Food Lover's Guide to St. Louis Neighborhoods. Lots of great insider information with recipes and a glossary of food terms. She also contributes recipes to our website, eartheats.org. Up, working with animals is rewarding, but
it is hard work, so don't get me wrong. You know, when it was negative 20 and I had to come, you know, fill waters and scoop poop, I probably had to count my blessings a little more that day.
Michelle Pruitt of Uplands Peak Sanctuary introduces us to a couple of her rescued pigs. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Colorado made history when it opened up licensed marijuana retail shops this year. That means pot brownies are now big business. Food products infused with marijuana's psychoactive ingredient are available in stores across the state. But marijuana is still considered illegal by the federal government. So the existing food safety system can't ensure that marijuana-infused foods are safe. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more on what it takes to build an entire regulatory structure from scratch.
So we'll just go under. You want to limbo with me?
Christy Lunsford sneaks past a line of about 25 people at the 3D Cannabis Center in Denver and approaches a display case. Lunsford is the marketing director for Dixie Elixirs, a manufacturer of foods infused with THC, okay, a chemical in marijuana that gives you a high.
So our edible line has things like handmade, hand-dipped truffles.
And sodas, fudge, Tootsie Roll-like chews, and mints. Other companies churn out baked goods, granola bars, and butter. At one point, there was THC-infused beef jerky on the market.
So it really is a companion plant, whether it's used medicinally or for its lovely intoxicating features.
Okay. Lunsford's company, along with a handful of other edibles manufacturers, is ramping up to fill a new demand. Colorado's had medicinal marijuana for more than a decade, but now sales are open to the general public. That means the standard labels of consume at your own risk and buyer beware don't quite cut it anymore. Like any food company, Dixie Elixirs is worried about getting people sick. But unlike other companies, the FDA wants nothing to do with foods that include marijuana.
We are under a microscope, and even my competitors who are food novices, they really care about providing for the consumer and making sure they're safe. So this is our lab.
In a corporate park on the other side of the city is one of the country's only labs specializing in testing marijuana, CAN Labs. Owner Jennifer Murray got into the game early and is now about to reap the benefits.
The CAN Lab started in a space of about 150 square feet. This is about 500, and we're moving to 2,000.
New state rules set to go into effect this year will require more testing of marijuana products in labs like Murray's. Until this point, tests for foodborne pathogens, dangerous chemicals like butane, and the potency of THC were voluntary, meaning few companies actually did them. Murray says it's important for consumers to know what they're getting into, or else they can end up taking too much all at once.
You can feel like you're dying. Your heart rate speeds up. You sweat. You can throw up. I mean, it's awful. So with edibles, it is very important that they get tested and that you know your dose.
The rulemaking process, which took place last fall, has raised even more questions. Murray's lab isn't certified, and she can't find any credible agency to do it. The State Department of Public Health has been reluctant to take any kind of regulatory role with marijuana. A portion of the department's budget comes from the federal government. That means the lion's share of the enforcement and creation of the industry's rules comes from a small division of the state's Department of Revenue.
Now, I came into this with a very open mind.
Louis Koski is the Division of Marijuana Enforcement's new director.
To a large extent, we're learning a lot as we go along. And, you know, the right thing to do, you know, from a regulatory standpoint is to make sure we can comprehensively regulate all these businesses and ensure the health and welfare of the citizens of Colorado.
Colorado's marijuana experiment has pushed the Department of Revenue into areas it never would have been before, like food safety and lab certification. And because Colorado is one of the first states to regulate recreational marijuana, all eyes are on Koski to see if the regulation actually works.
It's a new agency. If you were just going to start up a new agency and a public policy arena that wasn't this divisive, it'd be pretty challenging. And then you insert some of the complexities that go along with varied ideas on how this should all be carried out, and it certainly adds a little bit more pressure to it.
Colorado has taken innovative steps in ensuring public safety. And in terms of foodborne illness, eventually you might be safer buying an edible marijuana product than produce at the grocery store. They've rolled out a system that tracks all marijuana plants from seed to sale, meaning if a pot brownie caused a salmonella outbreak, you could track it all the way back to the source. That tracking system is just one piece of a much larger regulatory scheme used to keep the recreational marijuana industry in check. And other states curious to see if they can cash in on the green rush will be watching. I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Michelle Pruitt says farm animals are out of sight, out of mind, and that's partly why she helped found Uplands Peak Sanctuary. They rescue animals that would be killed for food, and they let them live out their lives on their property in southern Indiana. They opened their barn doors in the fall of 2012, and now they're housing four of the most charismatic pigs you'd ever have the pleasure of meeting. Earth Eats' Lauren Galapa has this audio postcard.
I'm like, you know, I'm not going to change it. It's adorable.
Uplands Peak Sanctuary.
She knows her name? Oh, yeah, they all know their name.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, they can be across the field. And
My name is Michelle Pruitt, and I'm co-founder, along with my husband, Mark Pruitt, and actually president of the board. We plan on rescuing, you know, any animal that would typically be raised for food. So, you know, they can come from cases like these guys escaped, but pigs also fall off trucks on the way to slaughter. They fall off transport trucks, and then they don't really have a place where they could go live out their life. So there's cases like that, and there's cases where people will rescue for whatever reason. You know, someone has a change of heart. And we'll call animal control or call a sanctuary and actually rescue an animal from a factory farm.
How did you get her on your property? What's her story?
Okay. Annie and her brother Andy actually came from Minneapolis. And although it's illegal, there's a lot of backyard butcher that happens. So they believe that, you know, these guys escaped from someone's backyard. Most likely were going to be, you know, on the dinner plate that night, probably. And I'm pretty sure Annie led the escape because she's pretty smart, pretty spunky, and definitely of the two has been the leader. So Andy still had twine wrapped around his back legs, and they were roaming in a field in the middle of downtown Minneapolis. So the local animal control picked them up, and, you know, their story was on Facebook because there really wasn't anyone locally that would take in a farm pig that, you know, knew how to care for them, but most importantly was going to let them live out their life.
What do you get from having them in your life?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's where the immense gratitude comes from, because even though we just started, you know, so many people are so grateful that we're doing this, but, you know, I feel blessed that this is my life, and it is hard work, so don't get me wrong. You know, when it was negative 20 and I had to come, you know, fill waters and scoop poop, I probably had to count my blessings a little more that day. But, you know, really to see these animals and to get to know them as the individuals that they are, and just the relationship that I already have with them, just being with them a few months. You know, like yesterday I came in and snuggled up with Andy, and Andy, I like to tuck them in, so I kind of put their straw around them real good every day. And Andy just kind of squeezed in between me and Andy and laid her head on my knee and just let me love on her. And, you know, for me, I'm glad that I'm able to do that for them, but there's also this piece of knowing that I was part of the cycle of violence that all animals are in, that it's kind of like in some way I get to make up for that now.
Michelle Pruitt of Uplands Peak Sanctuary. Information about how to get involved at uplandspeaksanctuary.org. And thanks to the newest addition to the Earth Eats team, Lauren Glapa, for that story. Time for one recipe today. The winter just won't quit, so let's make a soup today with some basil and tofu and a big head of broccoli. The soup is actually tasty warm or cold, so keep it in your back pocket for when it does get warmer, if it ever will get warmer again. Chef Daniel Orr grew this broccoli himself.
If you grow broccoli in your garden, you'll get one really nice big head of broccoli from each plant, but you cut that off and then it will send out some other little shoots of broccoli, and that's what I've got here. The leaves of the broccoli are also great for the soup, but you got to get rid of the caterpillars.
Oh, sure enough.
So, are
the leaves something that you could, I don't know, steam and serve with?
Yeah, if you're doing a stir fry, use them like you would use any greens. You can use them as you'd use beet greens or collards or any of those kind of things. Now I've got some water boiling. Now for this recipe, we want to cook the broccoli till it's tender. Put a decent amount of salt in there because that's going to allow the water temperature to actually increase over the boiling point, and it'll cook the vegetables even quicker. In the meantime, we're going to go back to our trusty blender. We're going to put everything except for the broccoli into the blender and get it ready to whirl. A half a jalapeno, 2 garlic cloves, 15 basil leaves, 2 tablespoons of ginger, and a half pound of silken tofu. As soon as that stem is tender enough, it's ready to go. And again, the better blender you have, the less cooking you have to do to the broccoli. I'm going to add one little ladle of this cooking liquid.
I was going to ask if we were going to use the dregs of the broccoli.
Yeah, you can also save that and almost have it as a vegetable stock after you've cooked a lot of different vegetables in it. And then the other thing you can do is let it cool down and then take it out and water your plants with it, if you don't have salt in it, of course.
You guys, you reuse everything in this house.
So then again, this is a soup you could have either hot or cold. When you pour it freshly out of that blender, it's kind of a little bit foamy and light, and I think it will just kind of dance on your tongue.
Great recipe. Find it on our website, along with archived episodes of the program, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Lauren Glapa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Clara Moore, Daniel Orr, Michelle Pruitt, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thank you for tuning in today. Have a great week. I'm Annie Corrigan.